Everybody, this week on the Music Biz Weekly podcast, it's episode 600. We look back at how things have changed in the podcasting world and in the music online world in those 13 years.
Welcome to the Music Biz Weekly podcast, founded in 2011 and with over 500 weekly episodes, where Michael Brandvold and Jay Gilbert, two longtime music industry pros, discuss the very latest trends, tools, and tactics that you
build
need.
A stunning band website in minutes with Bandzoogle. Go to Bandzoogle.com to start your free 30-day trial and use the promo code MusicBizWeekly to get 15% off the first year of any
subscription. Follow and rate us on Spotify. Subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. We appreciate
it. Everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Music Biz Weekly podcast. You got Mike and you got Jay. Today is going to be a fun episode. Not really any deep analysis. We're celebrating a few things here. This is the 600th episode of the Music Biz Weekly podcast. I mean, first of all, 600 episodes. What the F? I mean, I can't believe it. And
wow,
I went back and looked. The very first episode of the Music Biz Weekly podcast posted on March 18th, 2011. So by the time you're listening to this, it will be the 13th anniversary of this podcast. And before we hit record here, well, before we get into this discussion, Jay, we got to do some of that housekeeping stuff.
Yeah, we do.
Got to get out of the way. First of all, big shout out to Bruce and everybody at Hypebot and Bands in Town. All of your support is so important to us. And of course, to our sponsors. Jay, while I'm doing this, why don't you do a quick Google? When did Bandzoogle?
Oh, look, go ahead.
I know Disc Makers has been around for a while, but why don't you find out when both of those companies first launched? So today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Bandzoogle.com. For over 20 years, maybe that's the answer right there, for over 20 years.
Yeah, Bandzoogle.
2003. So for over 20 years, founded in 2003, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single page electronic press kit in just minutes. All the features you need to design an EPK are already built in, including fully customizable design templates, preset EPK page layouts, music players, images, text bio, and video embeds, a gig calendar and press quotes, and of course, access to Bandzoogle's amazing award-winning tech support team 7 days a week. The new EPK, wow, that's a tongue twister.
Easy for you.
EPK
to say.
Plan starts at just $6.95 per month. And Music Biz Weekly podcast listeners, head over to Bandzoogle.com, sign up, and you can try it for free for 30 days. And when you sign up, use that promo code MUSICBIZEPK, all one word, and you'll also get 10% off the first year of the new EPK plan subscription. That's Bandzoogle.com, promo code MUSICBIZEPK when you sign up for the EPK plan. And of course, discmakers.com. As we all know, vinyl has become such an important product out there, but it's mainly been a label product up until now because of high prices and tight supply with resulting long lead times. And that's kept a lot of independent artists largely on the sidelines. Yet artists want and need to be selling vinyl, but not many of them end up moving forward. Why? Again, because of the price and the turnaround times. Most artists don't know how many records they're going to sell, so they want to start with the smallest quantity possible to test the water so they don't end up with a garage or a basement filled with 5,000 vinyl albums that has no value and nobody wants. Up until recently, 100 vinyl records at Disc Makers was going to cost nearly $2,000 to press, and that's a lot of money. And it compares unfavorably to the cost of making just 100 CDs, which can start at just $149 at Disc Makers. So Disc Makers decided to rip the Band-Aid off, and they've launched an entry-level vinyl strategy perfect for independent artists with an offer of 100 vinyl records for just $1,299. So head over to discmakers.com, place your order for 100 vinyl records for $1,299. So, Jay, let's get into this kind of let's get into the Wayback Machine,
for you.
Peabody, Mr. Peabody. We're going to go back into the Wayback Machine here. So, what were your findings?
I was really surprised. We talked about Banzoogle launching, you know, in 2007. But let me see if you can guess without looking at Google, how long do you think Discmakers has been around?
I'm going to go, let me see. I moved to Chicago I'm going to say Discmakers has been around since 1985.
Very close, 87.
Okay. Cause I remember moving to Chicago in 87, taking my first music industry gig. And I remember right around then, if you wanted CDs made, I remember ads for Discmakers, and a lot of, you know, unsigned bands would go to Discmakers to get their CDs made. And there wasn't back then, I can't remember a lot of other options other than Discmakers if you wanted to get CDs.
Oh, wait a second. If you look on their website, it says they're celebrating 70 years of pioneering the DIY music revolution. So, I guess, it says the company started out in 1946 as a small factory in Philadelphia. So what we know as Discmakers has been around since 87. So the company itself has been around 70 years.
So they must have been a vinyl plant when they first started.
78s to 45s to LPs.
There you go. Wow.
Wow.
These guys know the business. They know this business and product.
Yeah.
I mean, there's major label pressing plants that aren't around anymore. And your Discmakers are still here doing it.
Pretty incredible.
So anyway, we thought let's kind of jump into the Wayback Machine here and go back to 2011. I had just started my marketing company a year earlier, and the podcast literally was started for just as a way for me to promote my business. That was it. I wasn't going to buy ads anywhere. I'm like, how can I get found on iTunes?
Yeah.
How can I get found on iTunes? Because iTunes existed.
But they didn't have a standalone podcast app at that time, right?
I don't think so. I think it was just in iTunes. Because I remember it's like, okay, you can search for me in iTunes and now you can find my podcast there. So that was the whole premise of it. But it was such a different world. I was like, boy, back then we were talking, you know, a lot of people may not remember this. There was a big company back then that was all about DIY, Topspin.
Yeah.
Topspin was it. Shortly after, remember a company called Root Music, and they had an app called Bandpage that you would put on your Facebook page, and basically was so incredibly cool. It turned your Facebook page into everything a musician would need.
Yeah.
And back then, 2011 was still very much the early days of social media.
Yeah.
Facebook was around. Twitter was around. YouTube had just launched 6 years earlier. Think about that. 2005 was when YouTube first launched.
Yep.
But none of those websites were anything like we are used to right now. TikTok didn't exist. TikTok wasn't even a glimmer in the eye of anybody at any point in time. Vertical videos, forget it. I mean, you know, cell phones.
Dude, the iPhone had only been around 4 years.
Exactly. 4 years the iPhone had been around. But it was very much, I want to say back then we were focusing a lot more, Spotify didn't launch in the US until July of 2011.
Yeah.
Spotify had officially launched in 2008, but remember, XUS, they first launched in Sweden, and it took them a number of years to make their way to the US. So it was a completely different landscape. You were still selling CDs. Vinyl wasn't an issue back then. Nobody was really dealing with vinyl. And t-shirts. You were selling CDs, t-shirts, and promoting your live shows, which still exists today.
Sure.
But you were doing it in such a different way back then, especially on Facebook. Facebook was, if you were around then and you'll remember, Facebook used to allow all these third-party apps to be installed into your page.
Oh, yeah. Made it great.
It made a,
and it was really upsetting when they let some of those things go, because they were tools that you and I used every day. And it was maddening when they would kill something off. Just let me interject really quickly. The I'm looking at Apple, you know, yes, they had podcasts. They didn't launch the standalone app until 2012. Before that, iTunes 4.9, which was in 2005, they started allowing podcasts. And today they have over 2 million episodes. But yeah, to your point, when you launched, that was prior to the standalone app for Apple for podcasts.
Back then, podcasts weren't like they are now. You know, in 2011, there were podcasts around, but it wasn't like everybody on every corner of the street had
no
podcasts. You know, there were no tools in place to do an aid in podcasting.
Yeah.
I remember back then we were using Skype. My original co-host, Brian Thompson, and I, we used Skype, and I had to buy a third party app in Skype to allow us to record. And it started out only as audio. I can't remember when I actually switched to video. Probably a year or so later, we switched to, or at we made the video available. We always recorded the video podcast, but then I would just strip the audio out. Because again, back then in 2011, it was just podcasts were just audio. And there were very few podcast destinations. It was a big deal that Apple allowed podcasts in the iTunes store. That was sort of like the queen anointing this new format of content and saying, yeah, this has got something going here. And for many years, basically until Spotify came around, Apple was the 8,000 pound gorilla in the podcasting world. I mean, they were it, and they were the only place. And it wasn't quite as easy to do podcasts back then, meaning the editing, the uploading, all of that. I mean, there's so many, you can go get an account on any website out there right now that does nothing but get you set up to do a podcast and takes care of all the distribution for you. It was all manual back then.
Yeah. And you remember that back then there weren't many podcasts. And I remember I was commuting, so I listened to podcasts and I couldn't believe the quality of stuff that was online. And there were early people like Adam Curry, who was one of the first people to do podcasts. And then he did this thing with John C. Dvorak, where they started doing a podcast, you know, years before most people did. And that really drew me into like, what other podcasts are out there? And the problem was, and I think you illustrate this, today it's so simple really to get syndicated and get your podcast out to all the platforms.
You don't have to have any tech knowledge or tech skills today to really do it.
Like music, right, Mike? Like today, if you and I recorded a song today, we could put it up on YouTube and SoundCloud. Globally, it's everywhere.
Yep.
Immediately, no barrier to entry. Well, it used to be in the music industry, man, you had recording studios were really expensive, and then distributors and labels, there was gatekeepers. But
I think CD Baby and TuneCore were around back in 2011. I'm pretty sure you could Google, but I seem to recall at least CD Baby. I mean, CD Baby's been around for a long time. All of the names CDs, they were around before digital existed.
Yeah.
But back to where I was going, like in Facebook, they had all these apps in there that you could add all this functionality in.
Yeah.
And it was great. You could have a YouTube app added into your page, and then you could have your YouTube channel videos displayed on your Facebook page and people could watch them right there. You could have Bands in Town. Bands in Town was launched in 2007. Bands in Town had an app that you could connect to your Facebook page that would display all of your tour dates and do everything right within in your Facebook page. Root Music, that was their whole business, was this whole suite of tools that you just installed. So back then, if I recall, a lot of the marketing and the discussion and the talk was these various apps, what do they do and how to install them? And again, the technical challenges and hurdles of doing all that. We still talked about content and strategy, but that was less important because it was a very tech heavy industry back then. I mean, even Topspin was a very tech heavy tool to utilize. It wasn't easy like it is today to utilize all these services.
Yeah. And then remember how big MySpace was. It launched in 2003 and you could pick your top few friends, and it was really competitive on who were your top friends that you would list. But people started using MySpace and using that URL to promote their music. It was pretty big. And you had mentioned CD Baby. CD Baby's been around since 1998.
That makes sense, because again, I remember them. I launched my very first website in 1995. That was pre-Amazon, pre-Google. Yahoo back in 95 literally was still two guys in a dorm room hand building a directory of websites. I remember CD Baby coming up pretty quickly as a cool way to buy. I also remember another website called CD Now, which was a CD retailer, which I think ultimately Amazon ended up buying CD Now. But it was like, wow, I could go online. Because remember, when Amazon started, they were a bookstore.
Oh, I know. I worked with them.
It was
working
a bookstore
for Universal for 18 years. And I remember going up to Seattle and having those meetings where they were entertaining, like ringing, like selling music. And that happened in 1998. That's when they first started selling CDs.
I think they might have bought CD Now and integrated that into Amazon. And now it was books and CDs that you could buy on Amazon. It definitely was not the department store of the world back then.
Yeah.
CD Baby in 98. I remember that. I remember that. Definitely.
And there were some companies that would sort of get bought up by other companies. I mean, people forget that Real Networks was really one of the first DSPs, and they were really, was it Rob Glaser? And it was really cutting edge before a lot of these people. And I remember it was so far ahead of its time that a lot of us at Universal were thinking, yeah, I don't think people are going to pay for a subscription to stream music. They still want to own it. I mean, even as MP3s started becoming popular, there was still that ownership. And we didn't think people would move to Access as quickly as they did.
You remember MP3.com?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
I
bought things from MP3.com.
Well, wasn't MP3.com big push or big sales pitch was it was a storage locker for your MP3s. And again, you got to remember, back then we were still dealing with, we were deep in the fallout of Napster. Businesses had been decimated by Napster. People didn't know how to deal with it. Apple's got their iTunes, but at the same time as iTunes, Apple is selling, you know, their computers with the slogan, rip and burn.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, put your CD in, rip it, which is basically saying, you know, steal the music off that CD. And MP3.com was like, well, maybe instead of us being the source for somebody to come to get the MP3s like a Napster, which got people in trouble, we're just going to be, you think about it, it basically was a Dropbox back in
Rip, Mix, Burn. I remember the ad campaign.
Rip, Mix, Burn. There you go. I mean, MP3 was a online storage locker, just like a Dropbox. You can upload your own files.
Want to guess when MP3.com launched?
19... Let's see. I started there in 98.
It surprised
99?
me.
99?
97, very close.
Yeah, I remember when I first started working with Kiss in 98, we flew down to San Diego to meet with MP3.com because we wanted to see about attaching an artist merchandising stores to MP3.com.
Yeah.
And I don't think they were around much longer than that because they got, even though they were basically a storage locker for your MP3 files,
yeah,
they still got in trouble for that.
Well, they got sued and there was a big payout. And then there was this big issue because the payouts went to these majors and they didn't pay that to the artist. The labels and distribution kept that revenue.
Kept it all.
Even though they sued on behalf of the artist. So I don't know what the resolution, because that was decades ago, but I do remember hearing about that.
What it comes down to is back in the mid 2000s, even into the late 2000s, everything was changing even more so than it is right now. As much as things change constantly now, back then it was a real wild west.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, online radio stations would pop up and people would be like, well, can you stream that? I don't know. You know, until somebody slaps their hand and says, you got to pay royalties for streaming that music. Well, you're an online radio station. There were no rules. There were no laws. There were no regulations.
Wild, wild west.
Businesses didn't exist a year before. And somebody just said, hey, let's create Napster. Let's create MP3.com. Let's create this. And it was sort of, let's see how this all flushes out over the next year.
Yeah.
Some of them are here. Some of them aren't here.
Some have been acquired. Some just died.
I was going to say real quick, going back to Facebook. I mean, eventually, is if you've been around Facebook long enough, you know, Facebook killed all third-party apps.
Yeah.
Which killed literally overnight, like a company like Root Music went out of business because their entire business was built on the back of Facebook. And when Facebook changed what they allowed you to do on a Facebook page, they were gone. And there was a lot of small companies that provided those
innovative
tools and services,
companies,
that were just like, plug this into your Facebook page and you can have an e-commerce store built right into your Facebook page. Oh, tomorrow Facebook says no more third-party apps.
Yeah,
you're out of business.
And as you and I know, the gasoline on the fire, the thing that blew up. Yes, we had the dot-com boom and, you know, in the late 90s, and that was amazing. But in the early 2000s, we sort of started transitioning from dial-up to broadband. And it changed the game because you'd only have that at work. Like I would go to work at Universal and they had, you know, high-speed internet.
But you were able to be online 24/7 at work, but at home you weren't online. You weren't online all. You had dial up. It's like even though you might have had an iPhone in 2007, you know, everything was different back then. Today it's a permanent connection where as long as you're in
a fast
decent metro area, you've got a fast permanent connection wherever you go wirelessly. Quick side, I remember when I was working with Kiss at the merch company and Apple introduced, was it called their Air Card? What did they call it back then? They introduced Wi-Fi for the first time. It wasn't called Wi-Fi. They had their own.
Yes.
Was that the one where
they had the spaceship shaped?
They had the white spaceship, and you'd have to buy a little PC card to plug in that gave you a wireless connection from your computer to this base station, which the base station was then connected to the internet. What did they call that?
I'm looking it up.
Airport. Airport. There you go. Airport. And I remember watching that keynote. And we even had one of them in the office. And I told our IT guy, I go, what the hell do I want Airport for? I'm in my office sitting behind my desk. My G4 Mac is connected by Ethernet straight to the network. Why do I want to be wireless from here to the wall?
Exactly.
I don't get it. I could not.
Well, I wasn't using a laptop. I was using a desktop, and I couldn't figure out why people would want to be wireless.
Yeah.
And then I remember I got my first MacBook Pro. And what was crazy about that is I really only used it for email, internet, and maybe a spreadsheet. But it was before Starbucks, where you could just go in and use Wi-Fi in different places. But when I was at work, we started putting wireless so you could bring your laptop into meeting rooms and stuff. Then the light bulb went on and I went, oh.
Exactly. That was the moment. It probably took me 6 to 12 months to get to that moment of going, oh, I get it. Because now there was an actual use case where it made sense. Otherwise, again, I'm sitting behind my brand new G4 on my desk in the office going, what the fuck do I need wireless for?
Yeah.
The Ethernet outlet is just 3 feet away over here. I got a cord. Who cares? It's going to be a slower connection anyway. For the life of me, I couldn't figure out what the benefit was for Wi-Fi when it first showed up.
How were people listening to the show when you first launched versus today?
Clear. I mean, it was all pretty much all iTunes. When we launched,
pretty much all iTunes.
It was pretty much all iTunes. I want to say, I mean, we weren't on YouTube, Spotify.
Were you posting it to your socials?
Yeah, I would share the link. I think you could get it through any other aggregator that took iTunes. Like TuneIn has always had podcasts in it. There were a couple even back then. There was Stitcher. Remember Stitcher?
Yeah,
they're no longer around. Yeah. They recently just disappeared. They were podcasts way back then. There were a couple early podcast aggregators that basically could take whatever was on iTunes and put it into their own dedicated podcast music app.
Yeah, they were early. They launched in 2008. And as you mentioned, they closed this last summer. But yeah, they were there early.
But back then, it was all iTunes, or it was something that took the feed from iTunes and just put it into another player. So that was the primary way people would, but it was almost all audio. I mean, when I launched Three Sides of the Coin, the KISS podcast, a year later in 2012, that launched right away as video as well. So it didn't take me long to realize the benefit of being on YouTube.
Yeah.
Now back then, so I would say it was probably mid 2011, late 2011 that the Music Biz Weekly podcast went video. I could probably go on YouTube and search to find the first video.
Yeah.
But again, the reason I did that was, first of all, I recorded the video anyway. Initially, I was just throwing the video out and keeping the audio.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, God, I want to be found on YouTube. Now, YouTube was nothing but user uploaded video and music videos back then. There was no shorts. They didn't have TV. They didn't have movies going there. You know, what you're used to now. It was just user generated content that people uploaded. And I quickly was realizing, man, YouTube, I need to be found on YouTube if people search for me. So let me upload the video of us like we do now. It's literally the same way it's always been from day one of video. And put that up on YouTube. And it really didn't take long for YouTube to quickly surpass iTunes in the amount of plays. Now, you know, in the podcasting world, especially back then, it was all about downloads because things didn't stream. Again, you didn't have a persistent high-speed connection everywhere. So if you listen to a podcast, what you would do is you'd probably go home, sync it to your computer, and it would download the episode. It would download all the unplayed episodes to your device, and then you'd listen to it. So podcasting was initially about, how many downloads did you have?
Yeah.
How many downloads? And it was not quick. What was quickly after launching this that I realized it's not about downloads anymore. It's about simple plays.
Of course.
Because as soon as broadband started coming in, it's like, well, you know, I used to be on Spreaker.com until recently because Spreaker started charging for podcasts, but that was streaming.
Yeah.
There's no download there. It's just somebody hit the play button. Right. YouTube is the perfect example. Nobody downloads a YouTube video and then watches it. No. You stream the video and you watch it. So it's a play count. It's a play count.
And it can be a little misleading, right? I mean, with my app, I like to listen to podcasts. Even when they're video podcasts, I'll listen to them, you know, my walks or when I'm traveling or whatever. And you notice with some of these, like with my app that I use, it automatically makes sure that I have the last five episodes of every one of my podcasts.
Yep.
Now, as much as I listen to podcasts, I don't listen to every single one of those, but those will show that I have them downloaded to my device.
Yep. So, you know, it didn't take long for YouTube to surpass iTunes in plays. It was just the, and it still is, it's the consumer destination for everything audio and video in the world. And to this day, I would say YouTube is the number one, Spotify is number two, iTunes is number three. And remember, 13 years ago, iTunes was far and away the number one.
Yeah.
And, you know, when Spotify really got into the podcasting world, they knocked iTunes off their high horse pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly.
And you're referring, of course, iTunes, and then they sort of transition to their standalone app, but it's all the same.
It still comes from the same. It comes from Apple. It's the same thing. So, it's just so interesting to think back. Again, we're talking 13 years. I mean, okay, 13 years.
Internet
years.
I mean, that's like dog years. That's like 100 years.
That 13 years wasn't long ago. I mean, as you looked up, YouTube didn't launch until 2005.
That's not that long ago.
2005 is when YouTube first launched everybody. And now, could you imagine an internet without YouTube? Not just from a business standpoint, from a personal standpoint, I use YouTube every day.
I still do. Yeah.
People will laugh at this. I don't even have a TV in our living room. There's no TV in our living room. We have one TV in the house, and it's in our bedroom. And that only is there to stream Prime Video, Netflix. We don't even have a cable TV account.
Yeah.
Finally got rid of that. And everything is streaming from YouTube to iPads to phones.
Mm-hmm. And do you think TikTok is going to be like that for these younger people who are growing up in this TikTok era? There's all this talk, you know, right now about it's already passed the Senate. House. Now it's going to the House about banning TikTok, and some countries already have. But this will be jarring and shocking to younger people, because just like YouTube, I can't imagine the internet without YouTube. For some of these younger people, I don't think they can imagine plugging in without TikTok.
I was thinking about that, and maybe this is me being a different generation. I don't know if it would be as huge an impact if TikTok was the only player out there. Then that would be decimating. But honestly, I watch more reels than TikTok. Instagram reels, Facebook reels. And YouTube Shorts. And let's be honest, they are all the same content.
Instagram stories,
as TikTok. So if TikTok as the destination disappeared, I only see that as a boost to Reels and Shorts.
Yeah, and
they're already there, and that content is still going to get created. It's just going to be uploaded to one less place.
Yeah, and YouTube, you know, look, their shorts are growing in leaps and bounds. But I also think whenever one platform like Friendster or MySpace or whatever it is, when they sort of go down, they're sort of taken over by something else. And I'm wondering if, yes, I think all these other things are true and people will put their ad dollars into those as well and they'll use them. But I also think that there could be a US-based sort of replacement for TikTok that doesn't have the concerns of having that data shared by the Chinese.
Yes. I mean, and that's ultimately what my understanding is. That's what could save TikTok, is if TikTok completely divests themselves and becomes a US-based company. But if TikTok, in a worst-case scenario, gets banned in the US, could you see somebody like Meta, Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube creating a standalone Reels/Shorts app? So you can capture the audience that, you know, kids don't want to hang out Facebook.
Right.
But the Reels are Reels in Facebook are as entertaining as TikTok videos.
Yeah.
It's a lot of times it literally is a TikTok video somebody uploaded.
That's right.
Reels.
It's just a different platform.
It's just a different platform. But to fill in a hole, if an app like TikTok disappears, maybe Meta or YouTube still keeps it bundled. But for those who don't want all the other crap around it, they just spin it out and make a standalone app.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, 13 years ago, Music Biz Weekly podcast first launched. This is episode 600.
Incredible.
What a crazy ride. It's been a blast. I have no interest in ending this anytime soon. As long as there's something fun to talk about in the tech space, we're here talking about it. It's just fun to look back. You know, here's what I would ask. Share your memory in a comment on Spotify or wherever you're watching or listening. Do you remember Music Biz Weekly podcast 13 years ago? You remember episode 1? Do you remember episode 100? How long have you been on this ride?
Yeah.
And one more real quick. Thank you to Bruce. I don't know how many years Bruce and Hypebot have been supporting us. It's been many years. It's been many years that they've been supporting us. And of course, to our sponsors, Bandzoogle.com and Discmakers.com. Thank you so much. And everybody, here's to 600 more episodes.
Yeah.
See you next week.
Industry professionals listen to the Music Biz Weekly podcast. If you have a product or service and would like to reach this audience, get in touch with Michael or Jay to discuss sponsorship opportunities.
For Music Biz Weekly, provided by LarryDavisVoice.com and by JessicaMarsVoice.com. That's Mars with a Z.